Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. This week's guest, Mary Carrillo. She does not even require an intro. You know Mary. You love Mary. She's fresh off the dog show, and now she's back in tennis. So we spend, wow, this is a long one, Jamie. We spend almost an hour talking tennis with Mary Carrillo, a free-form discussion. We hit on a number of topics, just some fun tennis talk with one of the great treasures this sport has to offer. So here's an hour with Mary Carrillo. Let's get right to it. Why did whiskey win best in show?
You didn't like Whiskey the Whippet?
I loved Whiskey the Whippet.
Yeah, that was a fine dog.
That's your winner.
It was an upset, though, I got to tell you. It was an upset.
Compare that in tennis terms.
That's, well,
is that Ostapenko?
I mean, Whiskey had been the finest whippet in the land.
I'll say.
But are you well? Do you want to do a podcast?
You ready for some shop talk?
I am indeed. But before we begin, may I pay you and Jimmy Arias a compliment?
Oh, last week's guest.
Yes, last week's guest I thought was terrific.
Oh, thanks.
I don't know if this is part of the podcast or not, but
yeah,
I want to
not?
Go on record. What's that?
You're on record. We're rolling now.
Oh, excellent.
Say hi to Jamie.
Hello, Jamie Lasante. Jamie, I don't know if you found Jimmy Arias to be as honest and candid and interesting as I did, but I've always liked him so much, and I thought it was very interesting that he took real pleasure that his 10-year-old charge had terrific footwork, because when I graduated from high school, I worked for the late Harry Hopman, terrific Davis Cup coach who started an academy the summer I graduated. And at that time, 1975, all I had on my courts were a bunch of kids who wanted to play like Bjorn Borg. And so they almost every one of them had wide open forehand stances, Western grips, and loopy backhands. And what I had to continue to impress upon them is that the reason Bjorn Borg was Bjorn Borg was because he moved so well. And he had remarkable footwork, and any great player is going to have great footwork. But that's not what they were copying. So I was very impressed that Jimmy Arias liked that so much about his kid at the IMG Academy.
You caught that when it's all about the feet.
It's all about the feet. Yeah. You know, when I was with Billie Jean King the first time she laid eyes on Steffi Graf, who was only about 13 at the time. And that's what Billie Jean went to. She said, oh, boy, look at her. She's going to be great. Look at her feet. And as we go on into 2019 and start making our predictions, I'm guessing that the young guys who are playing so well now and are looking to win majors, they're big and strong. And my assumption is the best mover among them will take the first major.
Ooh.
Because that's what separates, I think, really, really good players from great players.
That was speaking of deft movement, that was a great transition. That was some fleet footwork right there. You know what? As long as you brought that up and as long as we're going there, I'm not sure I see a great mover in. I mean, does anyone strike you for their movement?
Among the young guys?
Yeah.
Dennis,
notwithstanding.
Yeah, well, I think Borna Cioric is a beautiful. I mean, obviously, there's an important difference between footwork and foot speed.
Right.
A lot of them have foot speed and maybe not great footwork. But Ivan Lendl didn't have great footwork in the beginning of his career, but he got some great training and learned to move well. And he was a pretty big guy at the time, and I think that's what helped him so much. That in fitness, you know, got him to the very top. And I think Ivan Lendl will teach Sasha Zverev how important that is. He's already such a powerful, rangy, ropey guy anyway, that I think, I mean, I you know how impressed I am with him. I think sometimes you've been put off by his arrogance. Is that true to say? Is that fair to
no,
say?
No, I've been put off by his questionable results in best of five. No, honestly, okay. I don't mind the attitude. I'm just very skeptical that it's best of three versus best of five is a big distinction I'm not sure we always make appropriately.
And do you think that what has held Zverev back in best of five so far has been physical, mental, or emotional? Because, I mean, he's a young guy. He shouldn't get tired, right? Unless he's getting tired mentally or emotionally.
Don't you think they all sort of play into each other? I think physical, and I think it's the kind of thing you overcome and you learn how to pace yourself and you learn when to press and when to hold back a little. But
and that's why I like that he's with Lendl, Jeff. That's why I really like that he's with Lendl.
I think he's probably, you know, if you were going to pick a player to break through next year, if 2019 is going to end the monopoly of Federer, Nadal, Djokovic,
yes,
he's probably your first pick, though, isn't he?
I believe in him. I believe in his game, his power, his serve, his backhand, and his ambition. I mean, he was born to this. You know what I mean? He grew up around it. He grew up watching. I mean, he grew up basically on the ATP tour, watching his big brother train and compete, and having both of his parents so knowledgeable. So I do believe that this is an important 2019 is going to be fascinating. I do think it'll be harder and harder for Roger Federer to win a major again, and for that matter, apart from Roland Garros, I think it'll be harder and harder for Nadal to go 2 weeks. I mean, these guys are getting older,
right?
And there's no denying that, and that's okay by me. I'd love to see. Look, this year on the women's side, speaking of footwork, three of the four champions at majors were first-time champions. And when I talk footwork, right, you don't have to be big and strong to win the French Open. We saw the French Open winner this year finally take her first major. So, yeah, I think that's what we'll see in 2019 on the men's side too. Someone breakthrough.
I love that that the tennis gods give and they take away. That the players who don't necessarily have the most power tend to be the best movers. And, you know, John Isner serves very well. He's probably not your first pick in your rotisserie sprinting league. But
correct.
No, I think it's this sport's in a weird place, though. Wouldn't you agree with that? In a lot of ways. Some of it on the court, some of it the politics stuff that we probably dwell on too much. But interesting year, 2019, wouldn't you say?
I think it's going to be I genuinely look forward to it. I got to tell you the truth. After the U.S. Open every season, my interest in the game wanes until the very end because I love Fed Cup and Davis Cup, or at least I used to.
I was going
to
say.
I don't know how I feel about it.
What is this Davis Cup term you refer to?
Oh, boy.
But it wanes why? Because indoor is different.
I just feel like in Nadal tends not to play in the fall at that much. Serena doesn't play in the fall at all.
Right.
I mean, if fall makes, I think players fall off in large measure. But the people who are still trying to, you know, get into the last eight at the WTA event and the ATP Tour Finals, they still compete, and there's plenty of points to be. I got it. I have to dial back to one of my favorite Jimmy Arias stories. See, when he was only 16 years old, this is when we knew that Nick Bollettieri was going to be an absolute font of wisdom and unintentional hilarity. When
you got to do the invitation if you're going to tell this story.
Okay. When Jimmy was, I think he was 16 years old, he gets to the semis of Indianapolis, which is at the time was the U.S. clay courts. That's a pretty big tournament. And this was back in the day when Nick wasn't wearing shirts, you know, in the stands, and he was, you know, jumping up and down and going nuts. He explained why it was such a big occasion after Jimmy got off the court. He explained to the gathering press, "It's not about the money. It's about the points." Because the points are worth a lot of money. And it was at that moment that we realized Nick was going to say some funny stuff. So that's what I'm saying. So in the fall, people who are still trying to get, who are still looking for points,
right,
not the money, they're still going to compete in large measure. And for me, that I take a break a little bit in terms of interest. I mean, I keep a sporting interest in it. And then I wait for the next season, and I'm very much looking forward to 2019.
I always find that I mean, first of all, I have a hard time with indoor tennis. It's just weird to have this whole... First of all, it comes after the majors, and there's no major played on the surface, so it's a little bit of a sub-sport. But I would love one of our analytically gifted friends could probably confirm or refute this, but I always feel like the fall has pretty minimal predictive value. A lot of times players that have great falls don't necessarily carry it over, so it's not as though you feel like you're watching the next big thing.
That's what I mean. I'm all for the fall. I mean, it's my favorite time of the year to dress, for instance.
I was going to say, we love autumn, just not in tennis.
We love scarves and sweaters, it's probably not terribly professional of me that my interest wanes and drops off like that, but I'm back now, my friend. I'm looking forward very much to what's going to happen in January.
I think we talked about this last year, too. I think there's a real virtue to having a high-stakes event come early in the season. I never minded that. And at some level, you get rewarded for how you spend this scant off season. But I got no problem with tennis starting a major 12 days into the season.
I don't have a problem with it, and I understand why the Australian Open wants so badly to maintain those dates, which could change when the ATP Tour World Cup thing happens in 2020. But it's at the U.S. Open, you know, it's the end of the summer. Labor Day weekend happens during the U.S. Open. The same thing happens in Australia. It's the end of their summer. They've got Australia Day, which is sort of like a 4th of July day. They have, for all the same reasons that New York wants the U.S. Open to keep their dates, the Australian Open wants to keep theirs. And the build-up to the Australian Open, you know, they have their summer hardcourt season just as the USTA has theirs. So, yeah, I don't mind that at all. And frankly, you and I both know, John, because we love the Australian Open. The players they tend to be relaxed and fit, and they're not aggravated to see us yet. Until
exactly.
Maybe the third round.
Plus, exactly.
It's a nice time. To me, some of the best tennis of the year gets played at the Australian Open. Certainly on the women's side this year, that absolutely happened. I love the court speed. They've made it faster. It rewards daring. It rewards, shot making. It rewards aggression. Lots to like about the Australian.
And there's relative health. I always say the Australian, I don't know if you've ever, like, you go to spring training in baseball, and all these surly baseball players sort of feel fresh, and there's all this potential and this all the promise of a season. In tennis, you've got the spring training atmosphere with an event that actually means something, unlike spring training baseball games. All right, let's run through some topics, but then we had a request to talk to Mary Moore. People want to turn this into career day. I think there's a lot of curiosity about how you do your job, how you just did the dog show. But let's do a little tennis first. So I scribbled things down, which I usually don't take the time to prepare, but you make me nervous. All right.
I don't mean to.
Let's do game show style. Attack, defend, or modify the following assertions.
Okay.
The new Davis Cup is a win for tennis.
I sure as hell hope so. I don't feel that way. I've been critical of the Davis Cup ever since.
You're attacking.
I'm attacking. Yeah. I mean, I, and again, if you listen to Yannick Noah's impassioned speech, I mean, that thing, and Yannick can make it all sound. That guy, he has my number anyway. So I say that right up front.
Please read me your shopping list and I will see. Yeah, exactly. I'm with you.
I think it's an absolutely terrible date, November, and I know Dave Haggerty would love to switch that around. I think you can't have that many team cups. I think it's selfish and self-defeating to just cram an already ridiculous calendar in with some other thing at the end of the year. I hate the idea that $3 billion is being thrown around allegedly, theoretically, and not one dime of it has been earmarked for the women, for the Fed Cup. So, no, I've got a lot of issues with it. And if I get proven wrong, I'll be the first one to admit it, I promise you. I'll tell you. But I know it needed changing, it needed adjusting, but I think they really bent the needle in such an aggressive way that there'll be problems.
This was,
and
this
if
was
people
not
like
nuance.
Sasha Zverev and the French guys say that they're not even going, they're not playing it, and they're guessing that a lot of the other guys aren't playing it, and it seems that the top guys like Federer aren't committing to it. If you want a big event, you got to have big guys there.
No, it reminds me a bit about Brexit. And it's very easy to cast a vote. I mean, I think something did need to change and change fairly radically, but it's very easy to cast a vote and very easy to mention a dollar figure. And then when the rubber meets the road and you've actually got to exit the European Union and you're realizing that the economic model you voted on might not be the one that's going to be existing in reality, it's a little different.
I also didn't like that there was a lack of transparency throughout
with the voting.
And that really bothered me. The fact that a lot of money got thrown at a lot of different countries so that they'd come to yes, that bothered me. As I said, if it works well, I'll be the first to say I was wrong. I hope it works well.
I do think, and Dave Haggerty is, you spoke to him at length, I remember, during the U.S. Open, right?
I did. And, you've spoken with him as well. The guy is very optimistic. Much more optimistic than I am.
That's one adjective. But I will say on the gender point, he is he does speak fairly transparently about how he does hope that this carries over to a women's model too.
Yeah, but I don't think that this model is good for the men or the women. So you're going to get a bunch of 18 nations. I hate the wild card thing, by the way.
Yeah, that's a little
gross. And it's gross. And And by the way, I'm not saying that you need huge names to make Davis Cup or Fed Cup a great event. I mean, my favorite matches in Davis Cup so often come in the doubles. Guys that you might not really know that well, or when David Ferrer comes up with a huge win against Kohlschreiber in the Spain against Germany match, and Rafa Nadal is going absolutely nuts along with the rest of his team, cheering on the veteran. So many of the most amazing, exhilarating matches that come in Fed Cup and Davis Cup come because somebody, not the star, steps up.
Right.
Right?
No,
I mean, that's right.
I mean, I do think it's hard because we're seeing the flaws of both. When we go back and we think about 4 weeks, erratically spaced, you don't know who's home, you don't know who's road, the players are, I mean, this was flawed either way,
honestly,
but we'll see.
If I had a vote, and I didn't, of course, but if I could have shouted from the back of the room about what I thought might have made Davis Cup and Fed Cup more agreeable to players, I would have said, make it more rare. Don't make it every year, and don't make the winners play their first round to defend their title 7 weeks later.
Right.
I would have done that. As I said, I got no juice. I got nothing.
No, you know who has juice is the Panamanian Federation who got flown first class to vote. All right, so here's another one. Right now, right now, women's tennis is where the action is. Attack, defend, modify.
I'd modify. I'm every bit as interested in the men's side than the women's. So I love where women's. I think women's tennis is in a most intriguing state. But I feel the same way about the guys. So
really,
I guess I would. Yeah, I really feel that way. Again, I don't know what I think Novak Djokovic is going to keep winning majors.
Right.
I quote Andre Agassi from earlier this year when he said that if Novak were to get himself healthy again, he's 31 going on 25. I mean, the fact that Novak could get to 20 majors is not out of the question in my mind at all. So that is fascinating to me. Again, what Roger and Rafa, the returning Andy Murray, what he will do, what is Cilic going to figure out a way to actually win another one of these things? And again, all those young guys, Tsitsipas and Zverev and Borna, and I'm equally interested, I'd say, in the ATP tour.
Such a diplomatic answer.
I don't mean to be diplomatic.
Yeah,
I
right.
just feel that way.
It doesn't become you. you want a here? If I had to write, if Jamie Lasanti here held a gun to my head and made me write a think piece on tennis, one thing, we always talk about what's going to happen after these great generations and what's the NBA going to look like when Jordan retires. And what's men tennis going to look like when there's no Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, and you've got to try and sell, you know, Rublev against Zverev? Don't mean to pick on them. I feel like the WTA very sneakily, you know, Maria, who knows what the status of her career is. Serena's 37 years old and still competing, but hasn't won a major now in, you know, whatever it's been, almost 2 years. And I think women's tennis has really done a nice job transitioning to this new generation, and they haven't lost a lot of storylines, and there are a lot of players you're curious about how they'll play, and there's getting to be more consistency. I think the WTA has done a very nice job of transitioning from this Serena generation to a new one.
I agree with
the
you.
The men's tennis,
and I also,
less so.
Well, again, the guys haven't won majors yet.
Right.
I mean, what do we have? The last eight majors have on the women's side have been won by eight different players.
Eight different players, yeah.
I mean, that's if that starts happening on the men's side, they try hard. The ATP, God knows, they bend over backwards, next gen and new rules, and they've been doing this for a while. You know,
right.
New balls, please. That campaign has been going on for a long while. But that bunch of guys didn't come through the way that a lot of us thought. You know, when and I'm speaking of the off-injured Kana Shikori and Dimitrov and all those guys.
Right,
So I think the WTA is helped by the fact that the young players have stepped up, whether it's, you know, Sloane Stephens or Osaka, Ostapenko. I mean, they went legit.
Yeah.
So that's it. That's an easy thing to praise and to reward with fame and fortune and a lot of publicity.
Oh,
by the way, John,
yeah.
I was lucky enough to be a part of Billie Jean King's 75th birthday celebration.
I know, I was away. Yeah, how was
it
that?
It was at the New York Historical Society. It was the best night you could possibly imagine. And Maria Sharapova gave a speech that was so funny and so touching. I got to give her a big shout out.
That's great.
She brought the house down. She was terrific.
Wait, I was so disappointed. I was in, I was overseas and had to, I couldn't make it. Tell me more about it. We want to go find the YouTube videos.
There was my friend Helen Russell, who you also know, she archived a bunch of 75 of Billie Jean's, you know, greatest photos. And they were up and down the halls of the New York Historical Society, which I'm ashamed to say I'd never been to before. And it just kept coming. There were so many people there. When you've got Tony Bennett in the stands applauding, he was a guest. I mean, he was, you know, and so Emma Stone sang, who else? Kate Clinton, the comedian, gave an incredibly funny set. True Colors, a woman who's, I'm blanking on her name. She was unbelievable.
Maria Sharapova gave all right, we got to find that.
The tennis players who spoke included Alana Clause, her longtime partner, John McEnroe, who gave a classic John McEnroe speech that was veering off course and then bring it back in.
Brief and to the point.
But Maria was dazzling. Maria was dazzling.
Oh,
anyway, there was nonstop entertainment and laughter and love and dancing afterwards and drinks and food. It was a wonderful event. That's all there is to it.
American treasure. 75 years old. Wow.
75.
We should have
It was great. I there were cameras there. Sarah Bareilles sang. That's who. Cyndi Lauper sang.
Cyndi Lauper.
It was just. Wow. Cyndi Lauper sang a couple of times. She was extraordinary. And then on the dance floor, all of a sudden the music turned to "Girls Just Want to Have Fun," and there is Cyndi Lauper dancing to herself,
to her own song,
with Billie Jean King and the rest of us. It was quite a thing.
Oh man.
Yeah.
I did not know that. See.
Yeah.
Now you're, wow.
And now I'm just rubbing it in.
No, yeah, seriously. All right, you want more tennis questions or no?
Go, please, yeah.
Osaka or Sloane Stephens? Who finishes ranked higher in 2019?
That's a bit of a jump ball for me, but I am going to say it's going to be Sloan. I'm giving Sloan a slight edge. But it's I anticipate that they'll both be. They're going to create an awful lot of stories for us, both of them. And may I say that I truly hope in 2019, Arena Sabalenka, Arena
we love her,
Warrior,
right?
Arena Warrior Princess comes big at a major. I mean, one of the best matches of 2018 that I saw.
Best match of the Open. Yep.
Right? Yep. Sabalenka playing Sloane, right? I mean, that was. Sabalenka Osaka to me, what I'm thinking, oh boy, do this again 10 times next year,
right?
And just she keep giving us it,
yeah, and played her that was the one set Osaka dropped the whole tournament,
exactly. And Sabalenka, again, like the young guys, big, strong, powerful, bold, ambitious. I'm a big believer.
I'm telling you, women's tennis, a sneaky strong transition. Doesn't mean nobody's burying Serena. Nobody's writing off the chances that she may win another major or two. But if she's not in the draw, you're still watching women's tennis. That's my point.
Without question. Again, she wasn't at the Australian Open this year,
right?
And I thought the women's event was tremendous.
As long as we're we're still six weeks away, but there's no more tennis to be played before then, for all intents. Who's Wozniacki and Roger are your defending champions? Djokovic obviously has a nice track record in Melbourne. Who's winning this thing?
I can't go against Novak.
Right.
Not after the last half a year that he threw down. I mean, as Roger's form was degrading a bit as the year went on. Novak was just getting better. And, of course, Roger can win more majors, and I hope he does. But it was odd to see Roger up two sets and then a match point in the third at Wimbledon and lose that. It was strange to see him go out in the fourth round of the U.S. Open, although the weather conditions there were absolutely atrocious. I'm just not, you know, it's sort of like with Serena getting to two major finals and not winning one of them. If she's in the final, I'm assuming, you know, she's the one who's going to win.
Yeah, exactly. Only two players on the women's side got to the finals of two majors, and Serena was one of them. But
exactly. So that's some comeback. But
so you want to hear
it'll be interesting.
You want to hear my gossip?
What do you got?
So I have these moles. One of them told me that Nadal, they just saw Nadal playing craps at a casino in the Bahamas with a baseball cap on. He didn't. Very low stakes, didn't really understand the game. No one at the table knew who he was, and the dealer was getting pissed off at him. The other reader account I heard was that on Thanksgiving, and I was reminded that Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate holidays, but on Thanksgiving, okay. Serena was in Florida practicing very hard practice with her father fetching balls on the back of the court like it was the 1990s. All over again. But Serena playing on Thanksgiving. Read into that what you will.
I like both stories. I'm still shaking my head a little bit over the Nadal story.
In the Bahamas, no less, which is strange.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like he really needs to leave Mallorca to relax.
There's an island nation.
I'm not sure about that one. I'm not...
I trust my source, but no, you're
all right.
I think he's got the island nation category. He's pretty well sewn that up. But my question was leading you to Wozniacki, our defending women's champion. Halep, of course, played valiantly in the final and will go in, I suspect, as the top seed.
Coachlessly, though.
Yeah, that's an interesting
one. Didn't see that one coming. I think, I'm delighted that Caroline Wozniacki won a major. Do I think she's going to defend that title, especially with the news that she's got what sounds like a fairly crippling form of arthritis?
Yeah.
I think that's going to be hard for her. I think it's going to be real hard for her. And it's not for me to say, but I judge that maybe her priorities are starting to shift a little bit. She seems very much in love.
Right.
I don't know. As I say, I've got I'll be the first to admit if I'm wrong, if Wozniacki wins her second major in Australia. But I think that's not who I would pick.
Who would you pick?
Put it that way.
Who would you pick?
Who would I pick? Well, I heard this one woman's been practicing even on Thanksgiving Day.
Might her father have been in the background?
No. I obviously, anytime Serena enters a draw, I'm going to watch and see where she goes.
Right.
And Halep, obviously, is as good a clay court player as she is. She's still a tremendous threat on hard courts. And I'd love to see, again, I'm hoping that Arena Warrior Princess does something special in Melbourne. There's a play. I mean, why can't Osaka?
We've I was going to say, what about our previous major winner, Naomi Osaka?
And who also, she's won a couple of big hardcore titles. So, yeah, I would throw her in there for sure.
At the Grand Slam of the Asia Pacific, I'll have you know.
Correct. Can I tell you something, John? I'm going to be in Tokyo for the 2020 Olympic Games. And my guess, right, I've been trying to get NBC to allow me to do a bunch of tennis stories because it could be the final Olympics for so many of the people we've been talking about.
Yes.
And I got to assume Naomi Osaka is going to have one of the highest profiles of any Olympian in Tokyo. Correct?
I'll tell you a funny story. But no, absolutely. And I don't know how much, I mean, I don't know if people have a grasp here of what sort of position she's in and what sort of, I don't know if it's a unique set of pressure, but she has a level of notoriety in Japan that most American athletes can't relate to, and that's it. So I heard earlier this summer, I heard I was in Japan, I don't know, but last year I guess 2017 for a piece on this baseball player versus Shohei Ohtani, who now plays for the Angels, and the Japanese press there said that they've got this Olympics and the facilities are going to be great and the country's really going to support it and there's commercial support, and the only problem is there are no Japanese athletes, and the most popular male athlete is a baseball player who's going to play in the major leagues, and he's not going to be able to obviously play baseball during the games, and there are no Japanese athletes that this country can attach themselves to. He wrote me back after the U.S. Open, and he said, you know, we still are looking for a male, but we've got our female Japanese athlete. So she may be the face of these Olympics. And
yeah, I think so. And by the way, Kei Nishikori is pretty good on hard courts too.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Kei is going to be a big deal there as well. I should put Naomi. I buried her a little bit when you asked me who I think is a favorite to win it in Australia. Let me bump her up a little bit higher. And Sloane, I mean, look, you're right when you say that the WTA, there are so many rich storylines about the veterans, about the newcomers, about the proven ones, about the unproven ones.
Ash Barty is, I mean, I don't, there are a lot of sort of sub-stories too. Ash Barty. How are you, as long as you brought it up, how are you, A, with Olympic tennis, and B, with the ITF essentially saying Davis Cup and Fed Cup participation is a condition for playing?
I resent the fact that the ITA uses it as a carrot, you know, that you've got to
right.
represent your country. I mean, and it's something Caroline Wozniacki said years ago that always stayed with me. Because she was getting aggravated, I guess, that she had to play a certain amount of Fed Cups to play in the Olympic Games. And she said, every time I walk out on the court, I represent my country. Caroline Wozniacki is from Denmark. She's representing. And I agree with that. Of course, that is, you know, you have to play for your country a certain amount of times in the Olympic cycle. And that is, frankly, if the ITF loses that kind of power, then I don't think Serena or Venus or a whole bunch of players would ever bother playing Fed Cup or Davis Cup again. My assumption is that there's going to be wild cards thrown around. If someone like Roger Federer doesn't play for Switzerland in Davis Cup before Tokyo. I mean, I got to assume that the governing bodies understand that this will be the final Olympics for so many of the veteran players.
How do you deny
them that?
I would say as a general business model, as people who are cable subscribers, as the dwindling number of cable subscribers can attest, making people buy things that they don't necessarily want,
Yes.
Not a great long-term strategy. This is like, you can have playoff tickets, but you've got to buy the season package and go to the game against the Milwaukee Bucks before you're eligible. I'm not sure
just to belabor that point a little bit, it's why so many people, I don't know if this is what they do in the other countries, but Fed Cup, Davis Cup in the U.S., you've got to buy the whole 3 days, right? You've got to buy the full package, even though you might not be able to use it. And
yeah,
I think
that causes
a lot of resentment.
All right. This is great. We said we were going to have a free-ranging conversation. We've done just that. But we have all these requests for sort of career day advice. And I remember, I think the first time we ever did one of these, you spoke eloquently in some length about how you got started. But why don't let's talk about present day. The trite question is, how do you prepare? But what are sort of your guiding principles as a journalist, as a commentator? What do you try to do to differentiate yourself? Maybe I'll ask it that way.
Guiding principles for me, I want to be a very good storyteller. First and foremost, I want people who are watching whatever event I'm covering to care about the people who are on the playing field. So journalistically, I believe you've got to be well-sourced, be well-informed, and only then can you throw out an opinion. And you have to, when you get it wrong, you admit it. I during telecasts, if I screw up a date or a play or whatever, I'll always say, oh boy, unforced error. I think it's important to do that. And I've gotten to the stage, I've covered so many things now for so many years, for so many different networks, that at this stage of my pointy-headed career, I want very much to say yes to things I really want to do. I love covering the Olympics and the French Open and the dog shows for NBC. I love Real Sports with Ryan Gumbel on HBO. I love our tennis channel work, and you make it very, very special for me and everybody else. I like bouncing around. I like being able to go from sport to sport, pitching ideas for different stories, and trying to figure out a way to tell a good story and to tell the truth. So those are my guiding principles. I like saying yes to a pitch, to an idea. If it's got teeth, especially if it's got fangs, I like saying yes. I like doing profiles. I like people giving a rip about what happens when the contest is over.
I always quote you, and I don't appropriate. I quote you. I cite you. The athlete's heart is an admirable one. And you strip away all the bullshit and all the PR and the agents and the commitments, and you get to the essence of competition, and the athlete's heart is one to behold.
I love the athletic heart.
That's why
when people talk about, oh God, dumb jocks, how do you stand that? How do you deal with that? My feeling is that the resilience, the ability for so many great athletes that we get to cover, the fact that they can reset after some, devastating loss or some real setback or some injury, that will never stop impressing me and making me try to be a better person.
I love here. I'll give you a quick self-indulgent story, but I had a UFC fighter come by my office yesterday, and people said, oh my God, how could you watch that horrible sport? I said, look, think what you will of the sport. And it's some of it is indefensible, but just you're getting into a cage with another person who is trying to, divorce you from your consciousness. Yeah. How is that? You like to tell stories. You like to see bodies in competition and the virtues of an individual sport as a sport to write about and as a sport to tell stories about. How do you get more dramatic than that? I mean, you can be abhorrent. What they're actually doing, you can find abhorrent, and you can still really marvel at the athlete that goes in there and competes like that. Anyway, let me ask you a similar question, which is when you cover, I don't think it's unique to tennis, but I think it's maybe especially pronounced in tennis. these, you sort of have to pick your battle sometimes. And it's a close community. It's a community that I think collectively probably has some fairly thin skin. How do you pick battles? How do you figure out when to criticize and when to hold back, and when you know if you praise player X, you're going to hear it from player Y, and when you suggest a player get a coach, you may run into them in the hallway 5 minutes later, and they may confront you about that. How do you pick your battles?
Welcome to my life and yours. What I bank on, what I count on, is a reputation that I've tried to earn over the years. I mean, I'd like to think that, you know, it goes back to being consistent, you know, you treat things with gravity and with weight, and you hold people's feet to the fire. I mean, I've been, you know, I can be very critical, and it's because I genuinely feel that it's one of my roles is to be a caretaker of this game, a guardian of it. And right. So when I see things that I truly feel are wrong, when I get into arguments with producers or executive producers, why aren't we covering this? Why aren't we covering it right? Why aren't we covering it more? Why are we, you know, I get very, and you have seen this firsthand many times, I get very emotional. I get very passionate about trying to cover all the stories and to get it right. And, you know, it's a battle. I think I have more battles with the networks that are paying me than I do with the people I'm criticizing sometimes, which is no fun. But I think that's a really good point, though.
No, but I think people recognize that it comes from a place of investment, of emotional investment.
Yes.
We're all sort of tennis patriots in our way, and no one's doing it to thumb their nose at Serena Williams or take down the Australian Open, but it comes from a genuine place of wanting what's best for this crazy country.
And again, like, I've been in plenty of doghouses over the years, and then, again, I count on the fact that whoever thinks I've been unfair comes to see that I'm consistent, that I truly believe what I say, and I'm not just picking on their player or their agent or their coach or whomever, their association. I'm not just going after the ITF or the ATP or the WTA or the USDA. I'm taking my role as an announcer, a commentator, a journalist. I'm taking it seriously. I'm sure this happens to you too. I walk away sometimes, especially in tennis, which is the only sport I'm fluent in, and the one sport I care the most about. When I see things that I think are dead wrong, like, oh my God, I can't believe they're going after the money grab, or I can't believe this is another stupid turf war. I don't sleep at night, you know, and it bothers me, and it. That's the kind of stuff that do I pick my battles? I guess you have to temper them sometimes. and maybe I'm still learning how to get that part right.
One of the great ironies to me, I don't know if you have the same experience, is often it's the athletes who are most understanding and most forgiving and most sort of open-minded.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a lot of times it's the agents that stay pissed off for years, and the athletes, they're doing their job. And
I love it when an agent says to me, "Boy, oh boy, you have really got him angry. You have, and he can't believe you said that." And I will say, I play this one all the time. I'll say, "Oh, really? Give me his number. I'll call him myself."
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of times the player has no idea. They don't watch. They don't. They're not listening to.
Oh, I gave Mary Carrillo a piece of my mind. I did. You did.
It doesn't happen much, you know, it really doesn't. So navigating through all of that and trying to keep your own sense of self and your own way of thinking is tricky, but it's also very, very important. You know, everything counts. Everything matters. I've been telling this to my kids since they could understand what I was saying. And, And so to neglect, to let stories slide or let, you know.
Yeah, inconsistency. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you got to, people have to know where you stand.
So here's my Nishikori fleet footwork. Here's my transition to wrap this up. You were great, as always, predictably. But in a similar vein, let me ask you this. In this strange moment we're living right now, where you turn on the TV and there's, you know, whatever, tear gassing at the borders and pick your issue, kids in cages. Are sports diversion, or do they seem more trivial than ever? I mean, can you muster passion and outrage and elation for guys hitting tennis balls over the net, given this political climate? Or in some ways, is sports reassuring in a safe place where you can appreciate Roger Federer without worrying about, journalists being killed, or pick your issue du jour?
A long time ago, I read a story about a journalist who had gone over, I think, to Vietnam. It was, as I said, this was a real long time ago. It might have been Korea. I have it in my head that he was reporting from Vietnam, and the only thing that could stabilize and normalize the men he was interviewing was when they would ask him, so how many Yankees looking this year?
Right,
What's going to happen with it? And I just... it struck me even now as I'm telling you those words, John, it's making me smile that sports can matter most when it seems like maybe it should be marginalized. Because again, and I go back to the athletic heart, the way it beats, the way the commitment, the dedication, especially when you see the Croatians playing the French and the place is packed and Yannick Noah is crying just listening to the Marseillaise. And like it is transformative what sports can do, even in this god-awful climate that we're living in, this preposterous administration that we're living under, with all the god-awful things that are happening in the world. I just keep remembering that those guys in Vietnam wanted to know what the scores were, who's going to be pitching for the, that's the kind of stuff I guess I need to hold on to when things around me get a little bit too soul deadening.
I always say that you and I were there together, 2017 Australian Open, the same weekend of Muslim bans and this absolute chaos visited upon us. You've got Venus Serena, Roger Rafa, and
that's right.
The
the most that's civil. Exactly right.
Yeah. Anyway,
and we talked about it. It was such a relief. It was such a break from all the bad news. It was like, this is possible still. This is happening too.
And competition without polarization that you can
exactly. Yeah.
Hug your opponent when you're done. All right. This was fantastic. Predictably.
I always love talking
as
to
always.
You, John.
Likewise.
And I will see you in Melbourne.
I was going to say, next time I see you, we will be in another hemisphere.
Okay. I'll buy you a beer.
Thanks. You'll tell me all the deep, dark secrets off the record about whiskey best in show.
The whippet wins. Absolutely.
Whiskey needs a coach like Simona Halep. All right. Happy holidays, my friend. Thanks for doing this.
Back to you.
We'll do it soon.
All right.
Thanks, Mary.
Bye, Jamie.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
I'm a loyal listener.
It's so great to hear.
Thanks.
Bye.
All right, that does it for this week. Thanks to our guest, Mary Carrillo. Thanks to the many of you who said you need to get Mary back. It's been a while. It had been a while. Not a crazy while, but it had been almost a year. So nice to get Mary back on the podcast. Jamie Lasanti, we thank you for your production expertise and sorcery as always. You were here for that. What did we say? Freeform. We were here for that.
It was
like
nice
a freeform
grab bag. Podcast.
It was a grab bag. It pinballed a little bit, but that's okay.
No, it's good. I'm glad to hear that Mary is a podcast listener. And
yeah, I know. I didn't know what she was talking about. She said Jimmy Arias, and I'm thinking, Jimmy does some work for Tennis Channel.
I completely forgot that he was a guest on the podcast.
He was a great guest, and Mary was as well. I don't know. I'm always interested just for your perspective as someone who's late to the tennis party, but now you're in the middle of the dance floor. How do you like that?
That's good.
You like that imagery? I'm always curious sort of what – it's my standard setup question, but I'm genuinely curious as someone who comes at this from a different perspective. What strikes you?
Well, this was a grab bag, so there's a few things. At the end, I really liked just hearing about her entry into her world, how she approaches it. I think with anyone that kind of is at the top of their industry, it's really interesting to hear about how they approach it and kind of how they've overcome certain things. And like you said, in the beginning, when we first had her on, she really talked mostly about how she got into what she does now. But I'm on the same page as her, as I like how she loves to bounce around from different sports, and she goes from dog shows to covering the Olympics to tennis, and I think that's a really cool niche. But tennis-wise, I think I'm interested about what she said about Caroline Wozniacki, actually. It was a kind of a very slipped in there comment, but she said something, you know, it's not her place to say, but she thinks that maybe...
Mary said it's not her place to say, just to be clear. You're not condemning Mary.
No. I'm saying that she said kind of offhand that, you know, maybe she's nearing her end of tennis, or her kind of her priorities are switching, which I thought was interesting. Wozniacki made the announcement about her rheumatoid arthritis diagnosis and kind of didn't seem very talked about. I thought it was kind of remarkable because I know how debilitating that can be. So I think it will be an interesting thing to see, you know, if she can defend, but just not only excel in 2019 and what happens thereafter. You know, she's going to get married, I think, in 2019 or soon. So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting side note. We haven't really talked about her a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's a good point. I think rheumatoid arthritis is not something that we have necessarily a lot of familiarity with, especially as it pertains to 28-year-old athletes.
Right.
And then, strangely enough, she actually, I think, had some nice results after that announcement. I agree that sort of slipped between the cracks a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, fall tennis, as Mary talked about, is sort of a strange entity.
Yeah, that was the other thing I appreciated. You know, she's very candid to say that her focus and interest from the sport shifts a little bit in the fall, which I think is nice to hear. And yeah, I think it's good for someone. You know, I kind of feel weird saying that because, as you said, come in a little late. But for someone like her who's been involved for so long, to hear her say that, I feel like it's a little refreshing and nice to know that, you know, the fall season gets the best of all of us, maybe. So
yeah, I think being a tennis fan is also a little like being a tennis player, that nobody's playing 10 straight months.
Right.
Absolutely all out. Mm-hmm. And you take a few weeks off there. If you're Federer, you quite justifiably take off the entire clay season. Nadal tends to shut it down in the fall. You see players go sometimes 4 or 5 weeks without entering an event. You lose early in Wimbledon, and you've suddenly got 23 days or whatever it is built into your schedule. And I think it's the same for tennis followers. Even someone who follows it as passionately as Barry does, there's certain times of the year where you're following it more intensely. It's not like a team sport with a schedule in that respect. The fall is always strange to me, just the sense that you've played the fourth major, right? So what everyone's trying to peak their season to achieve, that's already passed. You're playing, and some of it is just logistics and time zones, and as a fan of the United States, sometimes it's hard to follow the results from Asia. But you're also playing on a surface on which they hold no majors, so I always thought that's a little bit strange. How pumped can you get for indoor tennis when the sort of tennis gods have told you it's not important enough a surface to hold a major event? And then you have these year-end soirees, which are great, but it's only 8 players, and you know, some of the players are really limping to the finish line. Del Potro didn't play London. Nadal didn't play London.
Right. So it's like how...
Serena didn't play Singapore. So yeah, it's like...
It's a remarkable achievement, but how much are we taking?
Exactly.
Speaking of soirees, Billie Jean King's birthday party sounded amazing.
Funny. I know. I was overseas working. I was doing what Mary does and doing some non-sports work in Europe. And I saw it on my calendar and I'm like, oh no. And I think Billie Jean, she just turned 75 Sunday. So this was, you know, 10 days or so in advance. I didn't realize.
It sounded awesome.
Star-studded gala. Yeah.
And very interesting about
that.
Yeah. Maria Sharapova, another person who 2019 should be an interesting year for her. I thought that was really interesting to hear from Mary, that I'm going to go search, see if I can find that video. of her.
It's funny too because I was thinking too. Maybe I've missed something somewhere that is shouldn't you know it should be coming to me and isn't. But I can't recall Maria Sharapova and Billie Jean King necessarily having such a close relationship. I mean, Billie Jean King was a Fed Cup captain, and she's known the Williams sisters forever, and they've played charity events, and obviously they've been tied to USTA events and American tennis. I can't quite recall a lot of Billie Jean King and Maria Sharapova overlap. I don't know, maybe she played some world team tennis once upon a time, but that was interesting. That was interesting to hear. And I do agree with your I think this is really sort of a make or break year for Maria Sharapova.
Right.
And
she's just on the cover of Entrepreneur magazine.
Is that right?
You know. Yeah.
I did not know that. That's
she built a business empire thanks to her winning team.
All right. We will grant her that. No, Maria Sharapova has always been very savvy. I don't know if you when you were at Wimbledon a few years ago, I don't know if they had a Sharapova store.
It's all over the place. All over the airports.
No, but at Wimbledon. I mean, literally, it's a pop-up store for the duration of the tournament.
Right.
And you're thinking, like, that's kind of a great idea. I wonder why more players haven't done that. It's a bit of enterprise. We will overlook the fact that you probably shouldn't be selling such unhealthy treats. But that's my village.
She needs. She's very healthy, though. She needs to make. We're gonna send a notice out to her right now. PSA. She needs to make some sugar-free, healthy, delicious gummies.
Gummies. She needs edibles. No, at least she doesn't have a family history of diabetes. Oh, I just went there. but back to your point. She is very enterprising, and I think when she is through with tennis, whenever that is. It'll be interesting to see what she does. She's not going to be, giving tennis lessons at the club. What else should we wrap with? Strange time of the year for tennis. Did you watch any Davis Cup action over the weekend?
I didn't. I was, holiday weekend. I had a
fun
race,
run.
Race
you had
on Sunday.
10-mile race. Congratulations on finishing that.
So, thank you.
I suppose this was predictable, but everyone, self-included, lobbied and rallied for change, and this Davis Cup is unwieldy and no one follows it, and 4 weeks out of the year erratically spaced playing best of five tennis is completely out of step with the times, and as directed, the head of the ITF blows this thing up and we're going to put a new proposal on the table. It's going to be condensed. It's best of three sets. We're going to compress this into 1 week. It's going to be in one central location so everyone can buy tickets ahead of time and the sponsors can come knowing where it is. And it sort of addressed the various and sundry concerns people had with old Davis Cup. And now we're all become very nostalgic. And I don't know if you saw some of the tweets or, as Mary referenced, heard some quotes from the French team, which, mind you, is a team that lost,
right,
saying, I've played in the last Davis Cup because what's coming next can no longer be considered Davis Cup. And we had a number of former players saying, it's what a pity, no one can experience this. We've suddenly become very nostalgic. To me, it's really about whether this financing is the financing they say it is, because you hear two very different stories. And if this is the billions and billions of dollars that were bandied about, that's great. And I think you can do a lot, not just in terms of inducing the players with big fat checks, but also with marketing and promotion. I've also heard figures that say that is wildly exaggerated,
right,
and it's more like $50 million, which would not necessarily
trigger
big changes.
You think that if the money's not there, the player interest and participation is not going to be there?
Yeah, but I also think, what else do you do with that money, right? You promote it, and you use it for corporate sponsors, and you use it for events and hospitality, and you make it into a thing. If that money isn't there, it's going to be an interesting first few years. And I also think we still haven't figured out this date on the calendar. And the ITF, from the very start, has sort of let it be known. I don't know if they publicly said this, but certainly there have been whispers that this November date is a placeholder, and they're really trying to get a September date. Ironically enough, the September date targeted is the one that coincides and corresponds with Roger Federer's Laver Cup. I'm not sure, what's the word from The Wire? What's the line? You pick a fight with a king and you best not lose.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the smartest strategy is to go after
And there's not many open weekends in that September.
No, and remember, it's after the U.S.
Right,
Open.
Right, like
so
it's
that's
not a very, when that was put on the calendar to begin with, we all were kind of like, I don't know if that's going to work. But I guess now that has sort of proven
Right.
It's format.
Labor Cup
and
is perfect in that time, right? Because you're coming after the U.S. Open and it's competition, but they're not huge points on the table. They're also it's a week that most players otherwise wouldn't play. It's not a terrifically strong week in terms of the other ATP events. It fits really nicely.
I think
this is going to be quite a tour for it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting because Laver Cup was, you know, had the benefit of just being a new thing, you know, and they could kind of do what they want and fashion it how they want. But as you said, everyone was so nostalgic at this point. They're really going to be competing against, like, history, you know, in so many years.
That's
of this.
A really good point.
And
yeah.
It's, you know, that's hard. I mean, I think nowadays we're split. We either like really love the new stuff and the new technology, or like everything is about nostalgia and the old school stuff. And you see all these things coming back. You know, they're just getting slightly revamped, but everyone likes the old school. So
you mean, I suspect you are not just referring to sports.
No. I mean,
look at every Hollywood reboot is
right. That
every Hollywood franchise.
Everything's coming. I mean, you can get a Polaroid camera now, like basically the same old school Polaroids. I mean, everything from the 90s is back in fashion. So
vinyl makes its return.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to see because this Davis Cup, you know, we always talk about tennis. We say it's so change resistant and, ooh, you play a tiebreaker. I mean, it's other sports are coming up with all sorts of innovations and three-point shots. And tennis in the last century, the best they can do is at some events you play first one to 7 points, win by two. And that counts for innovation. Well, this Davis Cup is what all the change agents have been lobbying for, which is really blow this thing up. And now there's clearly some backlash. So anyway, I stick with my Brexit comparison, by the way. Sounds good on paper, but when the rubber meets the road, you actually see how this pragmatically plays out. It's not quite as attractive. But anyway, that's among the many storylines to follow in 2019. Let's do one or two more of these. I don't think we need to do one every week, but let's do one or two more before
Sounds
the end of
good.
The year.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks, John.
If people were so inclined, where might they leave a future guest suggestion, such as Mary Carrillo? Where might they leave a review? Where might they subscribe?
Guest suggestions should go on Twitter.
Okay.
That's the best place, right?
We'll see it.
Podcasts, wherever they get their podcasts from, Apple Podcasts, hit subscribe, and they can leave a review there.
Sounds simple enough. All right.
Nice and easy.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Mary Carrillo. Thanks to our guests. Thanks for you for demanding we get Mary back on the show. We will have another guest soon, maybe even next week. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a good week.